This is Winfield Bible Camp 1998. Our general theme for the week is Next Year in Jerusalem. This is day four, the first period class with our brother Chris Sales, whose overall theme is Jerusalem, Trodden Down and Future Glory. Today's class is entitled The 20th Century Miracles. Our reading was Jeremiah 16, verses 14 to 21. Brother Chris.
Good morning, my dear brethren and sisters, the Lord Jesus Christ. Just one thing to open. Brother Ron Eason brought this book for me on Jerusalem, and we're just going to leave it up at the front here. You may want to, now you've got a little bit of the background and whatnot, want to flip through. There's lots of pictures and lots of information here. So I'm just going to leave this at the front. Brother Ron's given me that permission. So if you're interested, by all means, have a look at it. Well, I noticed we started about 3 or 4 minutes late, and I may need to buy back some of that time. So just to make note of that, Brother Chairman. We've only got 100 years to go through this morning, the 20th century, but it's just chock full of information. So I think you'll find that we still won't be able to do it justice, but we'll hopefully hit some highlights, and I hope this morning, some of the anecdotes that I relate to you are perhaps new and interesting for you. You know, modern Israel, brethren and sisters, is a modern miracle. Well, we've really seen the rebirth of a nation. When you think about it, we're going to see the whole process from conception, the period of pregnancy, if you will, to take the metaphor further, the birth pangs and the delivery. We've seen that in this century. You know, has it become too familiar to us? It's just kind of all, you know, just we're so familiar with it. It's just facts. You know, does it fail to move us? If perhaps some of you lived through some of these times, if you can remember what it was like to hear it on the news, the discussions that must have gone on amongst Christadelphians. I wasn't able to experience all of that. But even I can remember, like, the Gulf War and the anticipation. You just didn't want to miss a newscast. You know, we'd be every time we're in the car, the radio was on, what's happening now? These are the kind of things that we need to remember. And I think sometimes when we talk about Israel, and especially maybe because of, you know, the public lectures that we give, it's like, oh, yeah, here we go again. Here's a date, there's a date, this is what happened, that's what happened. And we forget that really this is a modern miracle. These people did not have a homeland for almost 2,000 years. The nation of Israel did not exist. And yet there it is now, front and center in the news paper, in world thought. There it is, the Middle East and in Israel in particular. You know, today I hope we can maybe rejuvenate some of that. We should be tingling all over and when we hear some of these things and think of the events that took place during this last century with Israel. And if you're not having that experience, then I guess that's my fault. But really, that's how we should feel when we think about some of these events. Now, just a little bit of background again. If you turn to page 19 in the booklet, I don't want to spend a lot of time with this, but it's important to understand some of the things that lead up to the events of the 20th century. And we've already gone through some of this, but at the top of page 19, under the section 19th century Europe, just to understand a few things. Number one, Israel particularly Jerusalem, was beginning to come into the consciousness of some prominent nations, Britain, France, Germany, Russia. There's a reawakening, if you will, of interest into that city, Jerusalem. Some of it was initially on religious grounds, as they were interested in the holy sites, that they helped to restore the city. They felt a certain obligation towards it. Meanwhile, in Europe in general, in Christian Europe, the persecution of the Jews goes on. This idea of blood libel was there, and it was beginning to spread, as we've mentioned in point number two there, amongst the Muslims. And persecution of the Jews then is coming really now from two fronts, both Christian Europe and now the Muslim, Arab, Turkish area, and those who had control of then the land of Palestine. And And so really, the Jews are feeling some pressure in all their places, unsettled still, and that's going to be very important because God must bring them back into the land as he had said he would. The reading, for example, which we had this morning. And so Jews were beginning to come back to the land at the time as farmers, settlers, the kibbutz that were being established. So this was happening late 19th century and into the 20th century. At the same time as the Arabs, with their sort of developing hatred and persecution toward the Jews, they were also growing very nationalistic, as point number 7 there says. And so you can see really that's the seeds of what we see in the land today. The section there, meanwhile, in Jerusalem, we've talked about some of that, the Christian infighting, the fighting between all three parties, really, Muslim, Christian, and Jew. Just a couple of notes there. Point number 6, in 1839, European governments were allowed to open consulates in Jerusalem. Okay, so again, this sort of reawakening to an interest in that city. And many of them did open a consulate in the city. And of course, that's going to have a certain impact on the city then. As we've mentioned there, medicine, education, technology began to flow into the city because there were representatives there from the major world powers of the time. And as we've mentioned in point number 7, and we'll come back to this a little later, Britain took a leading role in support of the Jews, encouraged by British Protestants who believed that when the Jews accepted Christ, he would return to set up the kingdom. So it's interesting to see that there was a biblical impetus for Britain to be involved in the reestablishment of Jews in the land and to their interest in the Holy Land. Of course, they felt that what they needed to do was convert the Jews to Christianity, and the Jews, although willing to accept their help in reestablishing themselves in the land, weren't too interested in accepting Jesus. Just over the page on page 20, just to sort of carry on with this theme, point number 13 there, the British supported Zionism to some extent, believing the Bible gave Jews title to the land of Palestine. The Europeans wanted Jerusalem for themselves, Christians having little regard for the rights of Jews or Arabs. So you've got a little bit of interesting politics going on there where Britain, who was influential in that part of the world, and specifically in Egypt and therefore going north into Palestine, they saw that Jews really did have title to that land and were interested in it. In fact, it would be interesting to listen in on a British parliamentary hearing or dialogue at that time. I don't know if you've heard what it's like these days in Parliament or in the Senate, but it sounds like a bunch of children playing and fighting in a playground. But in those days, they talk about things of little interest to us. But in those days, in the British Parliament, there was discussions of the Bible. They were opening up the Bible and reading passages like we've read this morning and discussing the implication of Jews going back to the land and how that was important to happen to fulfill Bible prophecy. And that was the motivation for much of the British involvement in the land. But the Christians of Europe were much, much more interested in just having it for themselves. And, they had already demonstrated throughout history that they had little regard for anyone else in the land, and that crusader spirit was still there. As, technology advanced and the world was more accessible to everyone, you can see point 14, there was a boom in Western visitors to the land. And it's interesting, you have a lot of archaeological information coming from that time period, late 1800s, as people began to dig about the holy sites. And many remarkable discoveries were made from that period of time. Now here's just a little interesting sort of point, just to tuck away, point number 15 there. As early as 1860, some Jews could see signs of impending persecution of Jews in Europe and tried to warn their fellow Jews to flee to Palestine and establish their own society. And that's, again, just some roots, just some of the seeds of what was to come later. And so that's fairly early on, 1860. Just in some of the writings and the dialogue, you can see that that they had a feeling that something, there was a dark cloud on the horizon of persecution. And of course, we know what eventually that dark cloud came to. Now, just as we start to come now more to maybe some more familiar things, point number 18 is perhaps a familiar name to you, Theodor Herzl, who was not a religious man, but saw the impending anti-Semitic catastrophe and devoted himself to finding a safe haven for Jews. Now, I haven't finished reading this particular book here, O Jerusalem, but there's an interesting note just with respect to Theodor Herzl, and I'd just like to read to you from it, because this was new to me. And again, it just gives a little bit of understanding maybe of what happened in this century here. And it had just gone through, there's a couple of pages listing all the things that had happened to the Jews, many of the things we've talked about with the Crusades and the blood libel and just the persecution that they suffered in Europe, where there had already been ghettos. That the word ghetto comes from this time period of Jews that were, you know, sectioned off and kept in squalor and so on. So he's gone through listing all these things, and then he says, "Yet by a strange paradox, the event which produced the decisive Jewish reaction to that blood-stained history was not a pogrom, not a slaughter, not a Cossack troop's brutality. It was a military ceremony, a ritual whose killing was spiritual, the public humiliation of Captain Alfred Dreyfus in Paris in January 1895. In the midst of the crowd massed on the esplanade of the Champ de Mars to watch the ceremony was a newspaper man named Theodor Herzl. Like Dreyfus, Herzl was a Jew. Like Dreyfus, he had led his life in comfortable, seemingly unassailable assimilation into European society, little concerned with his race or religion. Suddenly, on that windy esplanade, Herzl heard the mob around him begin to cry, 'Kill the traitor! Kill the Jew!' A shockwave rolled through his being. He had understood. It was not just for the blood of Alfred Dreyfus that the crowd was clamoring. It was for his blood, for Jewish blood. Herzl walked away from that spectacle a shattered man. But from his anguish came a vision that modified the destiny of his people and the history of the 20th century. It was Zionism. With the energy of his despair, Herzl produced its blueprint, a 100-page pamphlet titled, translated, The Jewish State." And that's Theodor Herzl's background, which I wasn't aware of. And it wasn't based on scripture, or he wasn't a godly man. It was simply this experience that he had to realize that no matter how assimilated we become, we are a separate people, we are a persecuted people. And he dedicated his life to finding a homeland for the Jews. Point number 20 there on page 20. Jerusalem was becoming modernized. There was water supply to the city. The railway from Egypt was widened and expanded. Much construction was going on outside the walls. In fact, under British rule at this point, the water supply was brought into the city and modernized. There was much work going on, and so Jerusalem is developing into a more of a modern city. Jews and Arabs both lived in the area, and as we've mentioned there, they both resented the rulership of Turkey. So Jews and Arabs really had some commonality there in the land and in the city, and they resented what was going on. In 1914, of course, World War I broke out, and Turkey sided with Germany against France and Britain. And this was very, very significant, because when France and Britain and their allies won the war, Turkey then lost its influence. And point number 22, British General Allenby took Gaza and then Jerusalem at this time. And this leads up to something that is familiar to us there, the Balfour Declaration. Now, you've got it there, what became known as the Balfour Declaration, in miniature there, sort of shrunk down on your page. That's the actual copy of the typewritten letter that Arthur James Balfour wrote. You can see his messy signature there and the typewriting. So just for your own interest, we'll just read it. He says there, "Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the cabinet." And this is the quote, this was the declaration which became later known as the Balfour Declaration. "His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation." And so Arthur James Balfour, the Foreign Secretary for Great Britain during this period of time, issued this statement, and you can see that it basically says, "We support the idea of a national homeland for the Jews." So just to kind of have a bit of a timeline running through here. Theodore Herzl, after his experience in France there, had a Zionist Congress in Switzerland, and in 1897, where he gathered together prominent Jews from around the world, and it was called later the first Zionist Congress, and they founded this Zionist movement. And their sort of goal after meeting together and making some statements was to find a homeland in Palestine for the Jews. Then in 1917, the Balfour Declaration says, yes, the British government views with favor the establishment of a homeland in Palestine for the Jews. Now, there's just a little interesting note there on the bottom of page 20. The Balfour Declaration put Britain between two hostile sets of people, the Muslim Palestinians who lived in the Middle East and the Jews who hoped to live there. Thus, the declaration provided the foundation for unresolved, ongoing conflicts that have plagued the Middle East for most of the century. So this was sort of the beginning of what we now see as an ongoing... I mean, the problem still isn't solved. It's an ongoing, festering sore. But this was the beginning of it. So that's World War I. Now, on page 21, we talk about the Holocaust. This is not the end of this story. With respect to this. In 1922, the League of Nations was formed. Now, the League of Nations is sort of the forerunner of what we now call the United Nations. And Britain was given a mandate by the League of Nations to establish a homeland for Jews in Palestine. So those first three points there on this overhead really is an interesting progression. First one says, Jews got together and said, boy, we'd like to have a homeland in Palestine for the Jews. Okay? Then 1917, the British say, we will do our best to facilitate the establishment in Palestine of a homeland for the Jews. In 1922, the League of Nations is formed, and Britain is given a mandate by all the nations of the world to say, go and do it. Establish a homeland for the Jews in Palestine. So what started as almost a dream, a wish, if you will, for the Jews in 1897, by 1922, the nations of the world were saying, go for it. Britain, you do what you can. But that didn't happen. And those of you that know your history, it's not until 1948 that there is actually a Jewish homeland, a Jewish state. So you have to ask yourself, what's going on? And really, it's the interplay here or the problem. What seemed like maybe a simple problem or a simple thing to solve really became much more difficult. And in World War I, many of the Arabs had helped the British and fought with them, Lawrence of Arabia, for example. And the British actually kind of made promises to both sides and found themselves caught between a rock and a hard place. So things went on and nothing was dealt with. And this then leads us to this time period leading up to World War II and the Holocaust. And I don't want to spend a whole lot of time on this. There's quite a bit of information here. Let's quickly go through it. You can see that during this time, there are some Jews returning to the land. Things are going on. Britain has this mandate that it's kind of sitting on and allowing to not come to fruition. It's made promises to both sides. It's kind of in an awkward situation. And in the meantime, the world is gearing, obviously, for another world war. Anyone could see that coming in the 1930s. And the Germans are actively already persecuting. Jews are fleeing. And the countries of the world are not accepting many of them. On page 21 there, some of the precursors to the Holocaust, even in the late 1800s, Jews were moving out of Europe. They could see what was coming. And many of them were going to the United States. Many of them didn't want to go back to Palestine. That was a hard life. That was a life of farming and difficulty. Just point number two there, just to kind of highlight this. From 1880 to 1918, the Jewish population in the United States went from 280,000 to 4.5 million. So you can see that many of the Jews flocked to the United States, and there are obviously many of them there still. There's more Jews in the United States than any other country in the world. Point number seven, meanwhile in Europe in the 20th century, many Jews in Russia and Germany had been assimilated into European life, even intermarrying and leaving their Jewish faith. So like Theodor Herzl, like Dreyfus, they thought they'd assimilated. Many had. And this was something else I found kind of interesting. And they thought from the Jewish perspective that they were just like anyone else, whether they lived in whatever country they lived in, Germany, Russia, anywhere in Europe, they considered themselves whatever they were. In fact, they fought for whichever country they were in. Many Jews fought for France in the First World War, and they fought as Frenchmen. Many of them didn't consider themselves Jews. But that wasn't to be. As point number nine mentions there, a person was considered a Jew if his parents or even one grandparent was a Jew. So even though they may have disassociated themselves, that was not how they were viewed. Many of you are familiar with Hitler and the Nazis, and they had this sort of view that their people, they called Aryans, were the superior race, and everyone else was below them. And just to understand where this hatred came from or how deep-seated it was, look at point 11 there on page 21. Nazis said Jews were a, and this is a quote, a genetically criminal race devoted to corrupting and undermining civilization. And the Germans blamed Jews for everything and anything. They blamed them for their defeat in World War I. They used them as scapegoats, if you will, in any situation. They felt that if there was any of this intermarrying and assimilation going on, it was because ultimately the Jews were trying to sort of undermine the German race, trying to spoil their pure genetic pool and and so on. And so they blamed them for all these sorts of things. And so anti-Semitism was on the rise in Europe. Point number 16, many Jews immigrated to France, Belgium, Holland, Austria, Britain, Palestine, USA, leaving behind all their property, savings, and belongings. So many of them saw what was coming. I mean, this is now, quite a ways on. We're in the 1930s now. They can see what's coming. That dark cloud on the horizon is a whole lot closer, and many of them are just getting out. But have a look what they're having to leave behind. And there were many not willing to make that sacrifice. They thought, well, no. I mean, it may happen to some people. It's not going to happen to me. Look, I'm good friends with all these people. I'm in this, well-to-do area. Surely my neighbors will not turn on me. Point 17 there. So many were leaving, in fact, that in 1938, many countries closed their borders to the Jews, as we've mentioned here on the overhead. Many countries, including our country, the United States, Australia, said, look, we can't take any more. We're going to have to kind of limit immigration. So there was definitely what I guess we would call a refugee flood. A key date to remember on point 21 there, 1938, now called the Night of Broken Glass. And this really kind of where things came to a head, if you will. On this night, German authorities destroyed Jewish properties and synagogues all over Germany and Austria. Mass arrests were made, Jews were sent to concentration camps, and children were expelled from school. And this was sort of a threshold or a turning point, if you will, the night of broken glass. Jews are still trying to flee, and Hitler's initial policy was, he was quite happy with this. Basically, he just wanted the Jews out. Initially, that was his goal. But in 1939, as point 23 there, Hitler changed from just wanting Jews to leave to wanting to kill them all. And this was, you know, now we're getting into, again, sort of familiar time. And this is the beginnings of World War II. Point number 24 there. As Germany advanced and took over other countries, it made destruction of the Jews a top priority. This happened in Poland and France. Ironically, a preoccupied Germany used precious time and energy in this endeavor. Often, railways clogged with Jews bound for the gas chambers slowed the movement of military weapons and supplies. Just kind of interesting to note that. You know, we know how the war turned out, and there were 6 million Jews, approximately, that perished in the Holocaust. But we also know that Germany lost the war, and you just wonder what impact their preoccupation with slaughtering Jews had upon their lack of success on the battlefield. We know, of course, God, through his angels, were in control of all these things, but it's just kind of interesting. Now, just at that point, I'd like you to, if you've got your Bibles open, to the reading we had in Jeremiah 16. There's many passages, of course, in Scripture that we could have gone to show that God, who had scattered his people throughout the world, was going to regather them. Many, many passages we could have gone to. This one particularly stands out in my mind for two reasons. The first one is in the first couple of verses that we read, 14 and 15 of Jeremiah 16, which basically says that God's regathering of the Jews into the land is going to outshine altogether his taking of his people out of Egypt. And so it says, they're not going to say the Lord lives that brought the children of Israel out of Egypt, but the Lord liveth who brought back his people from all corners of the world where they were scattered. And that's a message that we probably don't, as in the introduction, you know, we take it for granted. Oh yeah, there's Israel in the land now. Yeah, it is a phenomenal miracle, so much so that we should be able to say, this is an example of God. God lives, and he's demonstrated because he's brought his people back into the land that he promised unto their fathers. Now the other verse is verse 16. Behold, I will send for many fishers, saith the Lord, and they shall fish them. And I think you can see just from this overhead here and the notes in the workbook that we've seen that. There was plenty from 1860 they could begin to see the impending doom, and many of them went back to the land. It's as though God was trying to entice them back to the land. With little nudges and proddings, like a fisher might, to attract, using bait, the fish. But they weren't responding. And many of the Jews were just too comfortable in wherever they were throughout Europe. And so the verse goes on to say, and after will I send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them from every mountain and from every hill and out of the holes of the rocks. And by the end of World War II, brethren and sisters, they were flocking back to Israel, well, Palestine at the time, in numbers that it was just mind-boggling how many were going back. So much so that in the middle of all this, the British, who had control of that area still, from the United Nations perspective, limited immigration into Palestine to 1,500 Jews per month. That was like a drop in the bucket. That was 1,500 a month, and that was, I mean, they were... That was harsh, and there were many more Jews piling up in detention camps on the island of Cyprus and north of Palestine, kind of waiting, oh no, we've got to do this 1,500 per month. And that was because the hunters came. And it wasn't until that happened, when they, I guess, were fleeing for their life, so to speak, that the impetus became much stronger for many of the Jews. And just to finish off the Holocaust there, it's mind-boggling what happened, and I'm not even giving due justice. But Point number 27 there, you can see from 1941 to 1942, the final solution in brackets, or in quotes, the final solution, Hitler's so-called final solution, began. And his goal was to kill every single Jewish person in Europe. That was his goal. And at the time, there was probably, they estimate, about 11 million Jews at that time that he was going after, and he got over half of them. All who couldn't work were to be killed immediately. All others were to be worked to death in concentration camps, Poland being the chief extermination place. Jews were exterminated in various ways, gunned to death by machine guns or crowded naked into false showers and gassed with pesticide that would kill everyone in a few minutes. Germans then looted the bodies, removing gold teeth and hair, and then burning the bodies using the ashes for fertilizer. Those worked to death in camps were of great profit to the German companies that used them. The people were given only minimal food, no medical care, and of course not paid. The average lifespan in a concentration camp was about 9 months. Gruesome part of history, brothers and sisters, and what, 50-some-odd years ago? I mean, we're not talking about the Middle Ages now. We're not talking about crusaders slaughtering people. This is people who, many of whom are still alive today. Just a little interesting point there as we sort of end this Holocaust section and these hunters, fishers and then hunters. The Jews had the opportunity to return to the promised land before Hitler arrived. But a generation died in the wilderness of Europe before their children entered the land. It's kind of a little, as history repeats itself, eh? They had been given opportunity to go into the promised land, and many of them refused. And like those in the wilderness, a generation passed away, and it was their children, really, who have made the nation of Israel what it is today. Over the page, then, as we move now into this familiar time period, 1947-1948. Page 22, then, and time is marching on here. The Balfour Declaration of November 2nd put Great Britain on record as favoring a national homeland for the Jewish people in Palestine. We've said that. The League of Nations in 1922 said, go for it. So we see then this difficult situation that Britain was put into because they really had made promises to both sides and couldn't fulfill them. The frustration that was building amongst the Zionist followers with Britain broke out. You can see point 7 there. There was a struggle between Jews and Britain as Britain turned away refugee boats, arrested Jews, and took away weapons while radical Jews bombed British headquarters. And so really there was almost a little guerrilla warfare going on between Jews and the British. And so British, who initially had favored the homeland, were going to give their best endeavor. Remember what the Balfour Declaration said? Ended up so that in 1947, there was actually war, a guerrilla-type war, between Jews and the British. Point number 8, in early 1947, a frustrated Britain handed the Palestine problem back to the United Nations. Jerusalem had indeed become a burdensome stone, as it was prophesied to be. And it's interesting. I ask you to turn at this point to Genesis chapter 12. Brothers and sisters, Britain was very influential early on in what was going on in Palestine, and particularly with the Jews. And Britain was a very powerful nation, perhaps the most powerful nation the early parts of this century. And God had arranged things through his angel such that that nation, who had that kind of influence and power in the world, was given a mandate to establish a homeland for his people. And they waffled and stalled and delayed, made concessions to Arabs. Why? Well, Arabs had helped them win World War I. But I think, if you want to be a little bit more cynical perhaps, what else was perhaps behind that with respect to the Arabs? Why else might have the British not wanted to totally favor the Jews over the Arabs? What were the Arabs sitting on that was becoming more and more significant in the Industrial Revolution? And certainly oil would have played a major role in this. And the influence that the Arabs had and continue to have in this world, because God arranged them to be sitting on a gold mine, black gold, played into this. Genesis 12, verse 3, in the promises to Abraham, God says to Abraham, I will bless them that bless thee, and curse him that curseth thee. In thee shall all families of the earth be blessed. I would suggest to you that's a principle down through the history of time. Those that bless the Jews are blessed. Those that curse the Jews, the people of Abraham, will be cursed. And you can see, really, since that time, Britain's gone from a favored position to having not as much influence in the world today as they once did. In fact, they've had some very difficult times. And it may be ironic, it may be coincidence, or it may not, that when they favored the Jews, they were favored. And when they did not favor the Jews, they were not favored. Just something to think about. So they handed the problem back to the United Nations. They wiped their hands of it. Remember, in 1922, given the mandate, find a homeland for the Jews, 20-some-odd years later, they hand it back saying, we don't know how to solve it. So the UN came up with a plan to partition Palestine, which basically looked like this. I'm not sure, I don't think you have this one in one of the appendixes. You have a few maps in the back there. This is one I was actually given to me by a person who's in our Bible reading seminar and is planning a trip to the Holy Land, and he gave me a package of maps after I'd already sent out this document. So I thought this was a very helpful one to have. This was the plan, the United Nations plan in November of 1947. So theirs should be familiar to you, Mediterranean Sea, Sea of Galilee, Jordan River, Dead Sea. Everything in dark, black, was to be under Jewish sovereignty. Everything with the sort of shading was to be under Arab sovereignty. And you'll notice Jerusalem was to be given special designation. They said, neither of you can have Jerusalem. The international community will look after Jerusalem. So that was the plan. It's kind of a bizarre partitioning of the land. Imagine if this was your country here, and you came to a point where it basically wasn't even there at all, this little crossover point. And up here again, imagine trying to defend that land. You can't even hardly imagine it. Imagine if there was a province of Canada or the United States with this kind of configuration. You might say, well, for geographical reasons or something, that makes sense. And certainly there's no hostilities here, so we won't worry about it. But imagine throwing that mix into a place where these groups of people basically hate each other. Quite an interesting partition plan. Now, the Jews reluctantly accepted it, and the Arabs didn't. Now, a couple of notes there. Point number 12 on page 22. Just a few notes. And I think, brethren and sisters, we receive sometimes a lot of media misinformation. I think we don't realize the kind of influence and power that the Arabs have in this world, in the United Nations, in the media, and so on. Point number one, there has never been a Palestinian state. Before 1948, both Jews and Arabs were called Palestinians and were subject to ruling powers. So when you hear the term Palestinian state tossed around as though it's something that's gone missing and they want to find it again, it's never, ever existed. There's never been such a thing. Point number two, there have always been Jews living in the land. Sure, under the Mamluks or under the Ottomans or under the whoever's that were ruling, but they were there. Maybe not in the city of Jerusalem all the time, but they were there. And point number three just blows me away. The modern state of Jordan, which was formed in 1922, Jordan, when you hear about King Hussein and Jordan, you're talking about a modern nation. It did not exist before 1922. And it was given kind of as a present, if you will, or as a reward for service in World War I. The modern state of Jordan, formed in 1922, covers 80% of what was ancient Palestine. Jordan is down over here, in this area here, quite a large chunk. And this was all considered ancient Palestine. So Jordan, which is primarily Arab, received 80% of what was ancient Palestine. So when they came to make this partition plan, they had already given 80% of the ancient Palestine to the Arabs. The Arabs have already received 80% of ancient Palestine in the modern nation of Jordan. So then the United Nations come along and say, well, here's what we've got left. We'll divide it equally between Jew and Arab. The leftover 20% of ancient Palestine, we'll be equal about it. We'll make sure everyone's happy and divide it equally. That's the kind of justice that Jews receive in the land. You know, when they talk about equality and fairness, the Jews always receive the short end of the stick. It's always the way it is. And you don't understand that if you don't appreciate some of this history. Now, we've got to move on quickly here. Oh, man, this is incredible. Time is just moving on. All right. Okay, point number 15 there. On November 29th, 1947, the UN approved the partition of Palestine. Support was given by both Russia, who wanted Britain out of the area, and the USA, whose leaders were trying to please the Jews in America. That would have been an incredible vote of the United Nations to watch. And actually, this book here, which is a couple of inches thick, is just written about that time period. You know, a couple of years, and it's all about that time when the United Nations voted whether to accept this plan or not. Russia and the United States both supported it for differing reasons. And historian, Paul Johnson, writing on that time, when the State of Israel was proclaimed on May the 14th, 1948, wrote this, point number 16. Israel slipped into existence through a fortuitous window of opportunity which briefly opened for a few months in 1947-1948. That, too, was luck or providence. What a phenomenal comment from a historian who has no religious leanings. And just, I mean, can you imagine the angels at work at that time bringing things into place? There's an election in the United States just at the right time so that they're trying to win favor of the Jews in the United States, and so they support it. Their enemies support it. Some do, some don't. And Israel slipped into existence. Now, the Arabs had said that the day that Israel is declared a nation, we're going to drive it into the sea. We're going to push it into the sea. That threat was coming. You know, they had said that long before the lead up to this. They said, if you accept that and Israel's declared a state, we're going to invade and crush it. Now, just an example of media misinformation. As I see the time marching on, I realize I'm not going to cover as much as I wanted to, so I'll hit a few highlights that maybe you're not familiar with. The Arabs had said, when Israel is declared a nation, we will invade. Now, there were Arabs living in this part of Palestine at the time, what's known as the West Bank of the Jordan River. Okay, so the West Bank's right in here. And the Arabs, and in that place, Jews and Arabs had been living for centuries in harmony, neighbors. Arab leaders came to the Arabs and said, look, Israel thinks they're going to declare themselves a nation. We're going to wipe them out into the sea. Within a week, they're going to be gone. We're going to destroy them. You leave your homes, come over to this other side of the Jordan where you'll be safe. We're going to move in, destroy the Jews that live there. Within a week, they're going to be gone. You can come back. You can have your house, and you can have theirs. And these are people that had lived, grown up together, Jews and Arabs side by side. The Arabs said to the Jews, to the Arabs, you get out of the way, we're coming through. Just give us a week, you can come back and have your homes and theirs. Of course, it didn't turn out that way, did it? Because the Jews won. You had these hundreds of thousands of Arabs, thousands anyway, tens of thousands of Arabs, on this side now of the river, displaced from their homes, and they were left there. And they were just in tent cities, so it was only going to be a week, right? So they didn't make anything permanent. They were left there. They weren't welcomed back into the now state of Israel. The Arabs didn't look after them. You know how rich the Arab countries are. They didn't look after them. They left them there in squalor as a sign of what happens to the world when Jews do what they want to do. They were left there at the world, and the world said, look at what the Jews did by taking over this part of the world. Look what they've done to the Arabs. And it wasn't true at all. And when I first heard that, I thought, well, maybe that's sort of a biased view of it. Time magazine, May 25th. A nice picture of an Arab fella here with blood all over him. And it says, remembering a great disaster. Of course, this is in the context of May 14th and Israel being 50 years in the land, which got scant coverage in at least Time magazine anyway. Didn't even get a front page cover. I couldn't believe it. Palestinians last week remembered the birth of the State of Israel, or as they call it, El Nakba, the Great Disaster. The day that the Israelis declared independence in 1948 at the end of the British Mandate in Israel, an estimated 700,000 Palestinians fled from their homes and villages. Today there are some 3.5 million Palestinian refugees scattered across the Middle East. For the most part, the commemoration of the West Bank, Gaza Strip, and East Jerusalem was a peaceful demonstration, and it goes on to explain about it. 700,000 Palestinians fled from their homes and villages. The way it reads, it's like, you know, there they were being chased by Jews who were taking over their land. It's not true. They left this place. They were forced out by their own people. Their Jewish neighbors were saying, no, stay with us, you know, don't leave us. And they went across, and now 3.5 million refugees because of what the terrible Jews did. And it's not true at all. It's media misinformation. So Israel declared themselves a nation on May the 14th, 1948. And at that time, they were invaded by the Arabs. And as point number 17 there says, it was 600,000 Jews approximately in the land at that time versus over 80 million Arabs in the surrounding nations. They were completely surrounded. Egypt, Jordan, Syria, Lebanon, completely surrounded, and they were invaded. The very next day, May the 14th, they stand up and declare themselves a nation. The very next day, all the help from Iraq and Iran, tanks, everything coming in, airplanes, the Egyptian Navy came up here, sat off the coast, and was bombing Tel Aviv. The whole Egyptian Navy. Israel didn't have a navy. They didn't have an army. They didn't have anything. Hardly a thing at all. There's just a couple of stories, little anecdotes, just to kind of wrap things up here a little bit. A couple of Jews managed to get a little Piper Cub. It's a little small plane. And the whole Egyptian Navy sitting off here bombing away, they go up in this plane. One guy's flying it, one guy's in the back. And he's got some Molotov cocktails, homemade bombs. And they kind of fly it over. He'd open the little hatch thing and drop out a bomb. Sounded like that plane that Uncle Peter was in that told us about the other night. And they'd fly over and drop some bombs. And then fly back, refuel, get some more Molotov cocktails, homemade bombs. Fly over, do it again. On one of their final passes, they came dangerously close to sort of the main ship in the fleet of the Egyptian army. And they managed to get a fairly direct hit. And the ship started on fire. They got it into near the engine room, and the ship started on fire. The entire Egyptian Navy packed up and went home. They felt that, you know, the Jews were coming out of the skies. It was one little Piper Cub plane. Now, again, we might say, you know, coincidence, whatever. We say miracle. I mean, who was guiding those little Molotov cocktails? I'm sure the angels were helping out. And the mindset, I mean, how many times in the scriptures do we read where an army heard rumors or heard noises and left? I mean, it's a modern miracle, brothers and sisters and young people, for sure. Just a couple other things as we wrap up. And maybe one thing we'll do is leave the lessons there to read at your own leisure. Because there's at least a couple other little stories I'd like to relate to you in the context of Israel being a modern miracle. As time went on, and most of these dates are there for you on page 23. So the War of Independence, which Jerusalem won, incidentally, just I've got a good overhead here. Let's skip that. If you're interested in what territories they kind of won and lost and who was invading and so on, I've got some overheads up here. You're welcome to have a look at them. But basically, they expanded their territory and got most of what they have today, and then some. In 1956, the Suez Crisis, where the Arabs decided instead of trying to fight Israel with a war, they would try and fight them economically by closing some of the main economic borders and whatnot, the Suez Canal. 1967 is the next sort of significant one, what's known as the Six-Day War. Israel knew that it was a miracle that she was surviving, and she could not withstand an attack. So they always had their agents out in the world, and in 1967, June of that year, they knew without a shadow of a doubt they were going to be invaded. Intelligence had told them that. And so they launched what's called a preemptive strike. And basically what happened, for example, just looking here, the Israeli jets took off, went way out into the Mediterranean Sea, came around in behind Egypt, and their air force destroyed the entire Egyptian air force while it was still on the ground. And they did the same thing as they went up around into the north, and the same with the Syrian air force. And so they launched what was known as a preemptive strike. Now, just one little story that is kind of interesting. Of course, just before I forget as well, 1967 was significant in that they reclaimed the city of Jerusalem. And we think of the passage we looked at last night, Luke 21, it shall be trodden down of the Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles be fulfilled. So it wasn't until 1967 that Jews had control of the city. And we saw perhaps the beginning of the end of the trodding down of the Gentiles. There was a fellow named Eli Cohen, or Eli Cohen. And he was a Jew born in Egypt. And as a young man came to Israel, and they decided to make him sort of the supreme undercover agent for Israel, and they sent him to Argentina to open a furniture store, you know, very exclusive furniture. And all the while he was an agent, they trained him well and so on. And he got to know, he sort of hobnobbed with the leaders of the time, especially some from Syria. Okay, remember Syria's up in the north there. And he became sufficiently well acquainted that he eventually went to Syria. And the chiefs of staff of the Syrian army and so on would come to his home. They didn't know he was a Jew, obviously. They thought he was an Egyptian who had gone to Argentina and had this business. And he would hobnob with them and throw lavish parties, and they'd talk about all, you know, their strategy and what they were going to do. And then when they were all gone home, he'd phone up the Israeli embassy and tell them everything he knew. And so it's almost like Elijah who knew what was going on in the Assyrian army. He could tell them everything that they knew that was going on. And when the Six-Day War broke out, what was going on in the north was very significant, obviously. That you're familiar with the Golan Heights in the north. That's probably a good map to have. This one you may have in the back, I'm not sure. The Golan Heights up here in Syria, there's your West Bank. The Golan Heights, for years, the Syrians had been bombing the Jewish villages down below. So it was crucial for the Jews to get back the Golan Heights. They wanted the Golan Heights big time. From 1948 till 1967, 19 years, the Syrians had been bombing the Israeli kibbutz in the north of Israel. In fact, the children grew up in bomb shelters. They would come out in the evenings if there was a lull in the bombing to get some fresh air. The children were raised in bomb shelters in this part of Israel because the Syrians were constantly bombing. If you saw the land, the Golan Heights are up here, and Israel's down here, and they just were lobbing bombs over constantly. 19 years. Well, they wanted them badly. So Eli Cohen, an undercover Israeli agent, got to know the Syrians. And he went up there with the Syrians' chief of staff, and he wandered the hills. And, you know, the Syrians were kind of bragging about how the Russians had helped them fortify the Golan Heights with the strips of barbed wire, then a field of landmines, strips of barbed wire, field of landmines, and these great big pillboxes, you know, that they could shoot out of, both facing down the hill so the Jews couldn't come up, and also facing up the hill so if the Jews parachuted in and came down, they could shoot up at them. Just well fortified. All the time, Eli Cohen's making sketches of where the minefields are and where the barbed wire is, and asking the Syrian, oh, why did you do this? And that, you know, showing an interest, like he was just interested in the Syrian, you know, because he was a good Arab. Of course, the next day, he would wrap the drawings up, stick them in a table leg that he had made in his shop, and send it off. And it just so happened that another Israeli just happened to buy that table. And they had, so when they invaded in 1967 the Golan Heights, they had pictures of where everything was. And they could know exactly where to avoid the landmines and how to get through the barbed wire and so on. Not only that, where these pillboxes were, they were on the side of this mountain. It was quite sparse. And Eli Cohen said to the Syrian, you know, look, that's the pillbox there, it's right out in the open, that the soldiers there must get roasted in the sun. And besides, if the Israelis fly over, they'll see them. They're right there. I'll tell you what to do. There's a special kind of tree that I know of. It grows really fast. If you plant one near the pillbox, it'll grow up quickly, and you'll be better off for two reasons. Number one, your soldiers will have shade, and it'll be camouflaged. The Jews won't be able to see the pillbox. So the Syrian said, great idea. So they planted these trees near each pillbox. So Eli Cohen then just phoned the Israelis and said, when you're flying over, if you see this tree, bomb it, because there's a pillbox. That's a true story. And when the war was over, Eli Cohen, of course, was a great hero in the eyes of the Jews. But he was still in Syria, and he was making some calls back to Jerusalem and Tel Aviv and so on, and causing a little bit of electrical interference. And the Syrians caught on to it and found him and then realized what had happened and who he was. When the Jews found out that they had captured Eli Cohen, they said, look, give us Eli Cohen and we'll empty our prisoner of war camps. Doesn't matter how many, hundreds, thousands of Arabs. We'll let them go out of the jails if you give us them back. And of course they said no. The Syrians weren't quite too happy with what they found out what he had done. So they had him, you know, they abused his body and had him publicly executed and all that kind of stuff. The Jews said, look, okay, you've killed him. Give us his body, and we'll give you $15 million in agricultural equipment. And they said no. And they don't know where he's buried. The Arabs, you know, just abused his body. But that's how significant he was to the Jewish people, and you can see why. So that was 1967. The Jews won that war. It lasted 6 days, and again, their territory was expanded. In fact, that one thing I had on, they ended up taking over this whole Sinai Peninsula as well. And brothers and sisters, a couple of little stories or anecdotes that I related to you to try and make you excited about it, but also to make you realize it was a modern miracle, are just two of many. And I'm way past my time, so we won't go into any more. But there's several stories like that. This one's a fascinating one, the Yom Kippur War. They invaded on the Day of Atonement. Israel was unprepared, and they nearly lost. This war, they were within a few hours of being obliterated. As the Egyptians came up from the south, the Syrians and Iraqis came down from the north, and I didn't realize this, Israel was within a few hours of being annihilated and wiped out. And it was the hand of God again, and I could tell you some stories of what happened there, that Israel recovered themselves, and ended up winning this war as well. But obviously, I'm being told I'm meant to stop. It's just incredible. I didn't make it quite through halfway. Oh well, I did almost three quarters of the way through the century, and the story goes on. And certainly, what's going on in there in the land of Israel is truly amazing. I hope that the couple of lessons that are at the bottom there will be of some interest to you. The Holocaust. There's certainly lots of lessons from there. The Jews must have been wondering what was happening, had God forsaken them, when in fact he was on the verge of the greatest accomplishment for the Jews in 2,000 years. And so sometimes when our life seems difficult and we're struggling through it, we might be on the brink of something great that God's just bringing us through. And just a little note there at the end, to keep watching Israel. Jerusalem, I think, will be and will continue to be a significant place. And as we head towards the year 2000, I think that Jerusalem will be very significant. And there's a little note there that the Pope has already made plans to use Jerusalem to celebrate New Year's Eve 1999. And What's going to go on in that place, we don't know, and we hope that soon Christ will return and make it the city of the great king. Thank you.
Events are always more exciting than looking back at Babylon or whatever, and there's a ton of stuff, and it's right now. It's going on right in our lifetimes. We now have about 20-odd minutes.